Scotland you are. I thought I'd see for myself, and my other guest agreed to cooperate. When you stopped in the passageway, he was waiting in ambush, ready to draw his sword. His lordship seemed to regret having had to put Musashi to the test. But you perceived you were being lured into a trap and came across the garden. Looking directly at Musashi, he asked, "May I ask why you did that?" Musashi merely grinned. Takuan spoke up. "It's the difference, your lordship, between the military strategist and the swordsman." "Is it now?" "It's a matter of instinctive responses, that of a military scholar based on intellectual principles versus that of a man who follows the way of the sword based on the heart. You reasoned that if you led Musashi on, he'd follow. Yet, without being able to actually see or to put his finger on anything definite, Musashi sensed danger and moved to protect himself. His reaction was spontaneous, instinctive."
"Instinctive?
Like a Zen revelation. Do you have premonitions like that?" "I can't really say."
"In any case, I've learned a lesson. The average samurai, sensing danger, might have lost his head, or perhaps seized upon the trap as an excuse to display his prowess with the sword. When I saw Musashi go back, put on the sandals, and cross the garden, I was deeply impressed."
Musashi kept his silence, his face revealing no special pleasure at Lord Ujikatsu's words of praise. His thoughts turned to the man still standing outside in the dark, stranded by the victim's failure to fall into the trap. Addressing his host, he said, "May I request that the Lord of Tajima take his place among us now?"
"What's that?"
Ujikatsu was astonished, as was Takuan.
"How did you know?"
Moving back to give Yagyu Munenori the place of honor, Musashi said, "Despite the darkness, I felt the presence of peerless swordsmanship. Taking into consideration the other faces present, I don't see how it could be anyone else."
"You've done it again!"
Ujikatsu was amazed. At a nod from him, Takuan said,
"The Lord of Tajima, quite right."
Turning to the door, he called,
"Your secret is out, Lord Munenori. Won't you join us?"
There was a loud laugh, and Munenori appeared in the doorway. Instead of arranging himself comfortably in front of the alcove, he knelt in front of Musashi and greeted him as an equal, saying,
"My name is Mataemon Munenori. I hope you will remember me."
"It is an honor to meet you. I am a ronin from Mimasaka, Miyamoto Musashi by name. I pray for your guidance in the future."
"Kimura Sekiro mentioned you to me some months ago, but at the time I was busy because of my father's illness. How is Lord Sekishusai?"
"Well, he's very old. There's no way of knowing."
After a brief pause, he continued with warm cordiality.
"My father told me about you in a letter, and I've heard Takuan speak of you several times. I must say, your reaction a few minutes ago was admirable. If you don't mind, I think we should regard the bout you requested as having taken place. I hope you're not offended by my unorthodox way of carrying it out."
Musashi's impression was of intelligence and maturity, quite in accordance with the daimyo's reputation.
"I'm embarrassed by your thoughtfulness," he replied, bowing very low.
His show of deference was natural, for Lord Munenori's status was so far above Musashi's as to put him virtually in another world. Though his fief amounted to only 50,000 bushels, his family had been famous as provincial magistrates since the 10th century. To most people, it would have seemed odd to find one of the shogun's tutors in the same room with Musashi, let alone talking to him in a friendly, informal fashion. It was a relief to Musashi to note that neither Ujikatsu a scholar and member of the shogun's banner guard, nor Takuang, a country priest by origin, felt any constraint because of Munenori's rank. Warm sake was brought, cups were exchanged, talk and laughter ensued. Differences in age and class were forgotten. Musashi knew he was being accepted in this select circle not because of who he was. He was seeking the way, just as they were. It was the way that permitted such free camaraderie. At one point, Takuan set down his cup and asked Musashi,
"What's become of Otsu?"
Reddening slightly, Musashi said he hadn't seen or heard anything of her for some time.
"Nothing at all?"
"Nothing."
"That's unfortunate. You can't leave her in the lurch forever, you know. It's not good for you, either."
"By Otsu?" asked Munenori. "Do you mean the girl who once stayed with my father in Koyagyu?"
"Yes,"
replied Takuan, on Musashi's behalf.
"I know where she is. She went to Koyagyu with my nephew, Hyogo, to help nurse my father."
With a noted military scientist and Takuan present, thought Musashi, they could be talking about strategy or discussing Zen. With both Munenori and Musashi present, the subject could have been swords. With a nod of apology to Musashi, Takuan told the others about Otsu and her relationship with Musashi.
"Sooner or later," he concluded, "someone will have to bring the two of you together again, but I fear it's no task for a priest. I ask the assistance of you two gentlemen."
What he was actually suggesting was that Ujikatsu and Munenori act as Musashi's guardians. They seemed willing to accept this role, Munenori observing that Musashi was old enough to have a family, and Ujikatsu saying that he had reached a satisfactorily high level of training. Munenori suggested that one of these days, Otsu should be summoned back from Koyagyu and given in marriage to Musashi. Then Musashi could set himself up in Edo, where his house, along with those of Ono Tadaaki and Yagyu Munenori, would form a triumvirate of the sword and usher in a golden age of swordsmanship in the new capital. Both Takuan and Ujikatsu concurred. Specifically, Lord Ujikatsu, eager to reward Musashi for his kindness to Shinzo, wanted to recommend him as a tutor to the shogun, an idea the three of them had explored before sending Shinzo for Musashi. And having seen how Musashi reacted to their test, Munenori himself was now ready to give his approval to the plan. There were difficulties to be overcome, one being that a teacher in the shogun's household also had to be a member of the honor guard. Since many of its members were faithful vassals of the Tokugawas from the days when Ieyasu had held the Mikawa fief, there was a reluctance to appoint new people, and all candidates were investigated with great thoroughness. However, it was felt that with recommendations from Ujikatsu and Munenori, together with a letter of guarantee from Takuan, Musashi would get by. The sticky point was his ancestry. There was no written record tracing his ancestry back to Hirata Shogen of the Akamatsu clan, nor even a genealogical chart to prove he was of good samurai stock. He assuredly had no family connections with the Tokugawas. On the contrary, it was an undeniable fact that as a callow youth of 17, he had fought against the Tokugawa forces at Sekigahara. Still, there was a chance. Other ronin from former enemy clans had joined the house of Tokugawa after Sekigahara. Even Ono Tadaaki, a ronin from the Kitabatake clan, which was at present in hiding in Ise Matsuzaka, held an appointment as tutor to the shogun despite his undesirable connections. After the three men had again gone over the pros and cons, Takuan said,
"All right then, let's recommend him. But perhaps we should find out what he himself thinks about it."
The question was put to Musashi, who replied mildly, "It's kind and generous of you to suggest this, but I'm nothing but an immature young man."
"Don't think of it in that way," said Takuan with an air of candor. "What we're advising you to do is become mature."
Will you establish a house of your own, or do you plan to make Otsu go on indefinitely living as she is now?
Musashi felt hemmed in.
Otsu had said she was willing to bear any hardship, but this would in no way lessen Musashi's responsibility for any grief that might befall her. While it was acceptable for a woman to act in accordance with her own feelings, if the outcome was not a happy one, the man would be blamed. Not that Musashi was unwilling to accept the responsibility. On the whole, he yearned to accept. Otsu had been guided by love, and the onus of that love belonged to him as much as to her. Nevertheless, he felt it was still too early to marry and have a family. The long, hard way of the sword stretched before him yet. His desire to follow it was undiminished. It did not simplify matters that his attitude toward the sword had changed. Since Hotengahara, the sword of the conqueror, and the sword of the killer were things of the past, no longer of any use or meaning. Nor did being a technician, even one who gave instruction to men of the shogun's retinue, excite his interest. The way of the sword, as he had come to see it, must have specific objectives. To establish order, to protect, and refine the spirit. The way had to be one men could cherish as they did their lives, until their dying day. If such a way existed, could it not be employed to bring peace to the world and happiness to all? When he had answered Tsukekuro's letter with a challenge to Lord Munenori, his motive had not been the shallow urge to score a victory that had led him to challenge Sekishusai. Now his wish was to be engaged in the business of governing. Not on any grand scale, of course. A small, insignificant fief would suffice for the activities he imagined would promote the cause of good government. But he lacked the confidence to express these ideas, feeling that other swordsmen would dismiss his youthful ambitions as being absurd. Or, if they took him seriously, they would feel compelled to warn him. Politics leads to destruction. By going into government, he would sully his beloved sword. They would do this out of genuine concern for his soul. He even believed that if he spoke his mind truthfully, the two warriors and the priest would react either with laughter or with alarm. When he did get around to speaking, it was to protest. He was too young, too immature, his training was inadequate. At length, Takuan cut him off, saying, "Leave it to us!" Lord Ujikatsu added, "We'll see that it turns out all right for you." The matter was decided. Coming in periodically to trim the lamp, Shinzo had caught the gist of the conversation. He quietly let his father and the guests know that what he had heard pleased him immensely. The Locust Tree. Matahachi opened his eyes and looked around, got up and poked his head out the back door.
"Akemi!" he called.
There was no answer. Something prompted him to open the closet. She had recently finished making a new kimono. It was gone. Going next door first, to Umpe's, he then walked through the alley toward the street, anxiously asking everyone he met if they'd seen her.
"I saw her this morning," said the charcoal vendor's wife.
"You did? Where?"
"She was all dressed up. I asked her where she was off to, and she said to see relatives in Shinagawa."
"Shinagawa?"
"Doesn't she have relatives there?" she asked skeptically.
He started to say no, but caught himself.
Yes, of course. That's where she's gone."
"Run after her?"
In truth, his attachment to her was not particularly strong, and he was more annoyed than anything else. Her disappearance left a bittersweet taste. He spat and gave vent to an oath or two, then strolled down to the beach just on the other side of the Shibaura High Road.
A little back from the water stood a scattering of fishermen's houses. It was his habit to come here every morning while Akemi was cooking rice and look for fish. Usually at least 5 or 6 had fallen from the nets, and he would return just in time to have them cooked for breakfast. Today he ignored the fish.
"What's the matter, Matahachi?"
The pawnbroker from the main street tapped him on the shoulder.
"Good morning," said Matahachi.
"It's nice to be out early, isn't it? I'm glad to see you come out for a walk every morning. Great for your health."
"You're joking, I suppose. Maybe if I was rich like you, I'd be walking for my health. For me, walking's work."
"You don't look too well. Something happened?"
Matachi picked up a handful of sand and cast it, bit by bit, into the wind. Both he and Akemi were well acquainted with the pawnbroker, who had tided them over several emergencies. Undaunted, the man continued,
"You know, there's something I've been meaning to talk to you about, but I never seem to have the chance. Are you going out to work today?"
"Why bother? It's not much of a living selling watermelons."
"Come fishing with me."
Matachi scratched his head and looked apologetic.
"Thanks, but I really don't like to fish."
"Well, you don't have to fish if you don't want to, but come along anyway. It'll make you feel better. That's my boat over there. You can scull a boat, can't you?"
"I guess so."
"Come along. I'm going to tell you how to make a lot of money. Maybe 1,000 pieces of gold. How would you like that?"
Suddenly, Matahachi had a great interest in going fishing. About 1,000 yards offshore, the water was still shallow enough to touch bottom with the scull. Letting the boat drift, Matahachi asked,
"Just how do I go about making this money?"
"I'll tell you soon enough."
The pawnbroker readjusted his bulky frame on the seat at the waist of the boat.
"I'd appreciate it if you'd hold a fishing pole out over the water."
"Why?"
"It's better if people think we're fishing. 2 people rowing out this far just to talk would look suspicious."
"How's this?"
"Fine."
He took out a pipe with a ceramic bowl, packed it with expensive tobacco, and lit it.
"Before I tell you what I have in mind, let me ask you a question. What do your neighbors say about me?"
"About you?"
"Yes, about Daizo of Narai."
"Well, pawnbrokers are supposed to be skinflints, but everybody says you're very good about lending money. They say you're a man who understands life."
"I don't mean my business practices. I want to know their opinion of me personally."
"They think you're a good man, a man with a heart. I'm not just flattering you, that's really what they say."
"Don't they ever comment on what a religious man I am?"
"Oh yes, of course. Everybody's amazed at how charitable you are."
"Have men from the magistrate's office ever come around inquiring about me?"
"No. Why should they?"
Daizo gave a little laugh.
"I suppose you think my questions are foolish, but the truth of the matter is that I'm not really a pawnbroker."
"What?"
"Matachi, you may never have another chance to make so much money all at once."
"You're probably right."
"Do you want to catch hold?"
"Of what?"
"The money vine."
"Well, what do I have to do?"
"Make a promise to me and carry it out."
"That's all?"
"That's all. But if you change your mind later, you're as good as dead. I know the money interests you, but think hard before you give your final answer."
"Just what do I have to do?"
Matachi asked suspiciously.
"You have to become a well digger. There's nothing to it."
"At Edo Castle?"
Daizo gazed out over the bay. Cargo boats loaded with building materials and bearing the flags of several great clans, Todo, Arima, Kato, Date, Hosokawa, were lined up almost prow to stern.
"You catch on quick, Matahachi."
The pawnbroker refilled his pipe.
Edel Castle is precisely what I have in mind. If I'm not mistaken, Umpe has been trying to persuade you to dig wells for him. It'll be perfectly natural for you to decide to take him up on the offer.
That's all I have to do? How is becoming a well digger going to bring me that much money?
Be patient. I'll tell you all about it.
When they returned to shore, Matahachi was euphoric. They parted with a promise. That evening, he was to slip away unobserved and go to Daizo's house to receive an advance payment of 30 pieces of gold. He went home, took a nap, and awoke a few hours later with the image of the vast sum that would soon be his, dancing before his eyes. Money, a fantastic amount, enough to compensate for all the bad luck he had had up until then. Enough to last him for the rest of his life. Even more exciting was the prospect of being able to show people that they were wrong, that he had what it took after all. With the money fever upon him, he could not calm down. His mouth still felt dry, even a little numb. Going outside, he stood in the deserted alleyway facing the bamboo grove behind the house and thought, "Who is he anyway? Just what is he up to?" Then he began to go over the conversation with Daizo. The well-diggers were presently working at the Goshinjo, the new castle in the western encirclement. Daizo had told him,
"You're to bide your time until the chance presents itself, and then you're to shoot the new shogun with a musket."
The gun and ammunition would be on the castle grounds, under a huge, centuries-old locust tree near the back gate at the bottom of Momiji Hill. Needless to say, the laborers were under close surveillance, but Hidetada liked going around with his attendants to inspect the work. It would be simple enough to accomplish the objective. In the ensuing uproar, Matahachi could escape by jumping into the outer moat, from which Daizo's accomplices would rescue him.
"Without fail," he had said.
Back in his room, Matahachi stared at the ceiling. He seemed to hear Daizo's voice whispering certain words over and over, and recalled how his own lips had trembled when he'd said,
"Yes, I'll do it."
His skin covered with goose pimples, he jumped to his feet.
"This is awful. I'm going over there right now and tell him I don't want any part of it."
Then he remembered something else Daizo had said.
"Now that I've told you all this, you're committed. I'd hate to see anything happen to you, but if you try to back out, my friends will have your head within, 3 days at the outside."
Daizo's piercing stare as he had said this flashed before Matahachi's eyes. Matahachi walked a short distance down Nishikubo Lane to the corner of the Takanawa High Road, where the pawn shop stood. The bay, cloaked in darkness, was at the end of a side street. He entered the alley alongside the familiar storehouse, went to the inconspicuous back door of the shop, and knocked softly.
"It's not locked,"
came the immediate response.
"Daizo?"
"Yes, glad you came. Let's go into the storehouse."
A rain shutter had been left open. Matachi went into the outer corridor and followed the pawnbroker.
"Sit down," said Daizo, placing a candle on a long wooden clothes chest.
Sitting down himself and crossing his arms, he asked,
"Did you see Umpe?"
"Yes."
"When will he take you to the castle?"
"The day after tomorrow, when he has to bring 10 new laborers. He said he'd include me."
"Then everything's set?"
"Well, we still have to get the district headman and the 5-man neighborhood association to put their seals on the documents."
"No problem. It so happens I'm a member of the association."
"Really? You?"
"What's so surprising about that? I'm one of the more influential businessmen in the neighborhood. Last spring, the headman insisted I join."
"Oh, I wasn't surprised. I just didn't know. That's all."
"Aha! I know exactly what you thought. You thought it was scandalous for a man like me to be on the committee that looks after neighborhood affairs. Well, let me tell you, if you have money, everybody will say you're a fine man. You can't avoid becoming a local leader, even if you try. Think, Matahachi. Before long, you're going to have lots of money, too.
Yes, stammered Matahachi, unable to suppress a shiver.
Will you give me the advance now? Wait a minute.
Picking up the candle, he went to the rear of the storehouse. From a casket on the shelf, he counted out 30 pieces of gold. He came back and said,
Do you have anything to wrap them in?
No.
Use this.
He snatched a cotton rag from the floor and threw it to Matahachi.
You'd better put it in your stomach wrapper and make sure it's done up tight.
Should I give you a receipt?
Receipt? Echoed Daizo with an involuntary laugh. My, aren't you the honest one? But no, I don't need one. If you make a mistake, I'll confiscate your head.
Matachi blinked and said,
I suppose I'd better be going now.
Not so fast. Some obligations go with that money. Do you remember everything I told you this morning?
Yes. Well, there is one thing. You said the musket would be under the locust tree. Who's going to put it there?
Considering how difficult it was for ordinary workers to enter the castle grounds, he wondered how anyone could possibly manage to sneak in a musket and ammunition. And how could anyone without supernatural powers bury them so they'd be ready and waiting half a month from now?
That doesn't concern you. You just do what you've agreed to do. You're nervous now because you're not used to the idea. After you've been there a couple of weeks, you'll be all right.
I hope so.
First, you have to make up your mind you're going through with it. Then you have to be on the lookout for the right moment.
I understand.
Now, I don't want any slip-ups. Hide that money where no one can find it, and leave it there until after you've carried out your mission. When projects like this fall through, it's always because of money.
Don't worry, I've thought about that already. But let me ask you this. How can I be sure that after I've done my job, you won't refuse to pay me the rest?
Oomph! It may seem like bragging, but money's the least of my worries. Feast your eyes on those boxes.
He held the candle up so Matachi could see better. All over the room were boxes, for lacquered trays, for armor, for many other purposes.
Every one of them contains 1,000 pieces of gold.
Without looking very closely, Matachi said apologetically,
I don't doubt your word, of course.
The secret conversation went on for another hour or so. Matahachi, feeling somewhat more confident, left by the back way. Daizo went to a nearby room and looked in.
Akemi, are you there?
He called.
I think he'll go straight from here to hide the money. You'd better follow him.
After a few visits to the pawn shop, Akemi, enthralled with Daizo's personality, had unburdened herself, complaining about her present circumstances and expressing her desire to move on to something better. A couple of days earlier, Daizo had remarked that he was in need of a woman to run his house. Akemi had shown up at his door very early this morning. When he'd let her in, he'd told her not to worry. He'd take care of Matahachi. The prospective assassin, serenely unaware he was being followed, returned home. Hoe in hand, he then climbed through the dark grove behind the house to the top of Nishikubo Hill and buried his treasure. Having observed all this, Akemi reported to Daizo, who immediately set out for Nishikubo Hill. It was almost dawn when he returned to the storehouse and counted the gold pieces he had dug up. He counted them a second time and a third, but there was no mistake. Only 28. Daizo cocked his head and frowned. He profoundly disliked people who stole his money. Tadaaki's madness. Osugi was not one to be driven to despair by the sorrows and bitter disappointments of unrequited maternal devotion. But here, with the insects singing amid the Lespediza and Eulalia plants, with the great river flowing slowly by, she was not unmoved by feelings of nostalgia and the impermanence of life.
"Are you home?"
The rough voice sounded harsh in the still evening air.
"Who is it?"
she called.
"I'm from Hangawara's. A lot of fresh vegetables came in from Katsushika. The boss told me to bring you some."
Yajibe is always so thoughtful.
She was seated at a low table, candle beside her and writing brush in hand, copying the Sutra on the Great Love of Parents. She had moved into a small rented house in the sparsely populated district of Hamacho, and was making a reasonably comfortable living, treating other people's aches and pains with moxa. She had no physical complaints to speak of. Since the beginning of autumn, she had felt quite young again.
"Say, Granny, did a young man come to see you earlier this evening?"
"For a moxa treatment, you mean?"
"Uh-uh. He came to Yajibe's, seemed to have something important on his mind. He asked where you were living now, and we told him."
"How old was he?"
27 or 28, I guess."
"What did he look like?"
"Sort of round-faced. Not very tall."
"I wonder."
"He had an accent like yours. I thought maybe he came from the same place. Well, I'll be going. Good night."
As the footsteps faded, the voices of the insects rose again like the sound of drizzling rain. Putting down her brush, Osugi gazed at the candle, thinking of the days when she was young and people had read portents in the halo of the candlelight. Those left behind had no way of knowing how husbands, sons, and brothers who'd gone off to war were faring, or what fate might lie in their own uncertain futures. A bright halo was taken as a sign of good fortune, purplish shadows as an indication that someone had died. When the flame crackled like pine needles, a person they were expecting was sure to come. Osugi had forgotten how to interpret the omens, but tonight the cheerful halo, as colorfully beautiful as a rainbow, suggested something splendid in the offing.
Could it have been Matahachi?
Her hand reached toward the brush once, but drew back. As though entranced, she forgot herself and her surroundings, and for the next hour or two thought only of her son's face, which seemed to float about in the darkness of the room. A rustling noise at the back entrance brought her out of her reverie. Wondering if a weasel was playing havoc with her kitchen, she took the candle and went to investigate. The sack of vegetables was by the sink. On top of the sack was a white object. Picking it up, she found it was heavy as 2 pieces of gold. On the white paper in which they were wrapped, Matahachi had written,
"I still don't have the heart to face you. Please forgive me if I neglect you for another 6 months. I'll just leave this note without coming in."
A samurai with murder in his eyes was crashing through the tall grass to reach 2 men standing on the riverbank. Gasping for breath, he called,
"Hamada! Was it him?"
"No,"
groaned Hamada.
"Wrong man."
But his eyes sparkled as he continued to survey the surroundings.
"I'm sure it was."
"It wasn't. It was a boatman."
"Are you sure?"
"When I ran after him, he climbed into that boat over there."
"That doesn't make him a boatman."
"I checked.
I must say, he's fast on his feet."
Turning away from the river, they started back through the fields of Hamacho.
"Matahachi! Matahachi!"
At first, the sound barely rose above the murmuring of the river, but as it was repeated and became unmistakable, they stopped and looked at one another in astonishment.
"Somebody's calling him. How could that be?"
"Sounds like an old woman."
With Hamada in the lead, they quickly traced the sound to its source, and when Osugi heard their footsteps, she ran toward them.
"Matahachi, is one of you..."
They surrounded her and pinioned her arms behind her.
"What are you doing to me?"
Puffing up like an enraged blowfish, she shouted, "Who are you, anyway?"
"We're students of the Ono school."
"I don't know anybody named Ono."
"You never heard of Ono Tadaki? Tutor to the Shogun?"
"Never."
"Why, you old..."
"Wait, let's see what she knows about Matahachi." "I'm his mother."
"You're the mother of Matahachi, the melon vendor?"
"What do you mean, you pig? Melon vendor? Matahachi is a descendant of the House of Hongiden, and that's an important family in the province of Mimasaka. I'll have you know, the Hongidens are high-ranking retainers of Shinmen Munetsura, Lord of Takeyama Castle in Yoshino."
"Enough of this," said one man.
"What should we do?"
"Pick her up and carry her."
"Hostage? Do you think it'll work?"
"If she's his mother, he'll have to come for her."
Osugi pulled her scrawny body together and fought like a cornered tigress, but to no avail. Bored and dissatisfied these past several weeks, Kojiro had fallen into the habit of sleeping a lot, in the daytime as well as at night. At the moment, he was lying on his back, grumbling to himself, hugging his sword to his chest. "It's enough to make my drawing pole weep. A sword like this, a swordsman like myself, rotting away in another man's house." There was a loud click and a metallic flash. "Stupid fool!" Striking in a great arc above him, the weapon slithered back into its scabbard like a living creature.
"Splendid!" cried a servant from the edge of the veranda. "Are you practicing a technique for striking from a supine position?"
"Don't be silly," sniffed Kojiro.
He turned over onto his stomach, picked up two specks, and flicked them toward the veranda.
"It was making a nuisance of itself."
The servant's eyes widened. The insect, resembling a moth, had had both its soft wings and tiny body sliced neatly in two.
"Are you here to lay out my bedding?" asked Kojiro.
"Oh, no, sorry. There's a letter for you."
Kojiro unhurriedly unfolded the letter and began to read. As he read, a touch of excitement came to his face. According to Yajibe, Osugi had been missing since the night before. Kojiro was requested to come at once and confer on a course of action. The letter explained in some detail how they had learned where she was. Yajibe had had all his men out searching for her all day long, but the crux of the matter was the message Kojiro had left at the donjiki. It had been crossed out and beside it was written, "To Sasaki Kojiro, the person holding Matahachi's mother in custody is Hamada Toranosuke of the House of Ono."
"Finally,"
said Kojiro, the words coming from deep in his throat. At the time he'd rescued Matahachi, he'd suspected that the two samurai he cut down had some connection with the Ono school. He chuckled and said,
"Just what I was waiting for."
Standing on the veranda, he glanced up at the night sky. There were clouds, but it didn't look like rain. Very shortly afterward, he was seen riding up the Takanawa High Road on a rented pack horse. It was late when he reached the Hangawara house. After questioning Yajibe in detail, he made up his mind to spend the night there and move into action the next morning. Ono Tadaaki had received his new name not long after the Battle of Sekigahara. It was as Mikogami Tenzen that he'd been summoned to Hidetada's encampment to lecture on swordsmanship, which he did with distinction. Along with bestowal of the name came his appointment as a direct vassal of the Tokugawas and the granting of a new residence on Kanda Hill in Edo. Since the hill afforded an excellent view of Mount Fuji, the shogunate designated it as a residential district for retainers from Suruga, the province in which Fuji was situated.
"I was told the house is on Saikachi Slope," said Kojiro.
He and one of Hangawara's men were at the top of the hill. In the deep valley below them, they could see Ochanomizu, a section of river from which water for the shogun's tea was said to be drawn.
"Wait here," said Kojiro's guide. "I'll see where it is."
He returned shortly with the information that they had already passed it.
I don't remember any place that looked as though it might belong to the shogun's tutor.
Neither did I. I thought he'd have a big mansion like Yagyu Munenori, but his house is that old one we saw on the right. I've heard it used to belong to the shogun's stable keeper.
I suppose it's nothing to be surprised about. Ono's only worth 1,500 bushels. Most of Munenori's income was earned by his ancestors.
This is it, said the guide, pointing.
Kojiro stopped to inspect the general layout of the buildings. The old earthen wall extended back from the middle section of the slope to a thicket on a hill beyond. The compound appeared to be quite large. From the doorless gate, he could see, beyond the main house, a building he took to be the dojo and an annex, apparently of more recent construction.
"You can go back now," said Kojiro, "and tell Yajibe if I don't return with the old lady by evening, he can assume I've been killed."
"Yes, sir." The man ran swiftly down Saikachi Slope, stopping several times to look back. Kojiro hadn't wasted any time trying to get near Yagyu Munenori. There was no way to defeat him, and thereby take for himself the other man's glory, for the Yagyu style was the one actually employed by the Tokugawas. That in itself was sufficient excuse for Munenori to refuse to take on ambitious ronin. Tadaaki was inclined to take on all comers. Compared with the Yagyu style, Ono's was more practical, the aim being not to make a great display of skill, but to actually kill. Kojiro had heard of no one who had succeeded in attacking the house of Ono and putting it to shame. While Munenori was in general the more highly respected, Tadaaki was considered the stronger. Ever since coming to Edo and learning of this situation, Kojiro had told himself that one of these days he would be knocking on the Ono Gate.
Numata Kajuro glanced out the window of the dojo's dressing room. He did a double take and his eyes swept the room, looking for Toranosuke. Spotting him in the middle of the room, giving a lesson to a younger student, he ran to his side and in a low voice sputtered, "He's here! Out there, in the front yard!"
Toranosuke, his wooden sword poised in front of him, shouted to the student, "On guard!" Then he pressed forward, his footsteps resounding sharply on the floor. Just as the two reached the north corner, the student did a somersault and his wooden sword went sailing through the air. Toranosuke turned and said,
"Who are you talking about? Kojiro?"
"Yes, he's just inside the gate. He'll be here any minute."
"Much sooner than I expected. Taking the old lady hostage was a good idea."
"What do you plan to do now? Who's going to greet him? It should be someone who's prepared for anything. If he has the nerve to come here alone, he may try a surprise move."
"Have him brought to the dojo. I'll greet him myself. The rest of you stay in the background and keep quiet."
"At least there's plenty of us here," said Kajuro.
Looking around, he was encouraged to see the faces of stalwarts like Kame Hyosuke, Negoro Hachikuro, and Ito Magobe. There were also about 20 others. They had no idea of Kojiro's way of thinking, but they all knew why Toranosuke wanted him here. One of the two men Kojiro had killed near the donjiki was Toranosuke's elder brother. Though he was a good-for-nothing, not well thought of at school, his death nevertheless had to be avenged because of the blood relationship. Despite his youth and his modest income, Toranosuke was a samurai to be reckoned with in Edo. Like the Tokugawas, he came originally from Mikawa Province, and his family was numbered among the oldest of the shogun's hereditary vassals. He was also one of the four generals of Saikachi Slope, the others being Kame, Negoro, and Ito. When Toranosuke had come home the night before with Osugi, the consensus was that he had scored a noteworthy coup. Now it would be difficult for Kojiro not to show his face. The men vowed that if he did appear, they would beat him within an inch of his life, cut off his nose, and hang him on a tree by the Kanda River for all to see. But they were by no means certain he'd show up. In fact, they had placed wagers on it, the majority betting that he wouldn't.
Assembling in the main room of the dojo, they left the floor space open in the middle and waited anxiously. After a time, one man asked Kajiro,
"Are you sure it was Kojiro you saw?"
"Absolutely sure."
They sat in formidable array. Their faces, woodenly stiff at first, were now showing signs of strain. Some feared that if this kept up much longer, they would fall victim to their own tenseness. Just as the breaking point seemed near, the rapid patter of sandals came to a halt outside the dressing room, and the face of another student, standing on tiptoe, appeared in the window.
"Listen! There's no sense in waiting here! Kojiro's not coming!"
"What do you mean? Kajiro just saw him."
"Yes, but he went straight to the house. How he got admitted, I don't know, but he's in the guest room talking with the master."
"The master?"
echoed the group with a collective gasp.
"Are you telling the truth?"
demanded Toranosuke, the look on his face close to consternation. He strongly suspected that if the circumstances of his brother's death were investigated, it would turn out that he'd been up to no good. But he'd glossed over this in relating the incident to Tadaaki. And if his master knew he'd abducted Osugi, it wasn't because he himself had told him.
"If you don't believe me, go look!"
"What a mess!"
groaned Toranosuke. Far from sympathizing with him, his fellow students were annoyed by his lack of decisiveness. Advising the others to keep cool while they went to see what the situation was, Kamei and Negoro were just stepping into their zori when an attractive, light-complexioned girl came running out of the house. Recognizing Omitsu, they stopped where they were and the others rushed to the doorway.
"All of you!"
she cried in an excited, shrill voice.
"Come right away! Uncle and the guest have drawn swords! In the garden! They're fighting!"
Though Omitsu was officially regarded as Tadaaki's niece, it had been whispered about that she was really the daughter of Ito Itosai by a mistress. Rumor had it that since Itosai was Tadaaki's teacher, Tadaaki must have agreed to rear the girl. The look of fear in her eyes was most unusual.
"I heard Uncle and the guest talking. Their voices got louder and louder, and the next thing I knew, I don't suppose Uncle's in danger, but..."
The four generals emitted a collective yelp and lit out for the garden, which was set off from the outer compound by a shrub fence. The others caught up with them at the woven bamboo gate.
"The gate's locked. Can't you force it?"
This proved unnecessary. The gate gave way under the weight of the samurai pressing against it. As it fell, a spacious area backed by a hill came into view. Tadaaki, his faithful Yukihira sword held at eye level, stood in the middle. Beyond him, at a fair distance, was Kojiro, the great drying pole rising above his head, fire shooting from his eyes. The charged atmosphere seemed to create an invisible barrier. For men raised in the strict tradition of the samurai class, the awe-inspiring solemnity surrounding the combatants, the dignity of the deadly unsheathed swords, was inviolable. Despite their agitation, the spectacle momentarily deprived the students both of their mobility and of their emotions. But then two or three of them started toward Kojiro's rear.
"Stay back!"
cried Tadaaki angrily. His voice, harsh and chilling, not at all the fatherly voice they were accustomed to, arrested all movement on the part of his students. People were apt to guess Tadaaki's age to be as much as 10 years less than his 54 or 5 years, and take his height for average, whereas actually it was somewhat less than that. His hair was still black, his body small but solidly built. There was nothing stiff or awkward in the movements of his long limbs. Kojiro had not yet made one strike, had not, in fact, been able to. Yet Tadaaki had to face one fact instantly. He was up against a terrific swordsman.
"He's another Zenki,"
he thought, with an imperceptible shudder. Zenki was the last fighter he had encountered to have such scope and driving ambition. And that had been long ago, in his youth, when he traveled with Itosai, living the life of a shugyosha. Zenki, the son of a boatman in Kuwana province, had been Itosai's senior disciple. As Itosai aged, Zenki began to look down on him, even proclaiming that the Ito style was his own invention. Zenki had caused Itosai much grief, for the more adept he became with the sword, the more harm he caused other people.
"Zenki," Itosai had lamented, "is the greatest mistake in my life. When I look at him, I see a monster embodying all the bad qualities I ever had. It makes me hate myself to watch him."
Ironically, Zenki served the youthful Tadaaki well as a bad example, spurring him to higher achievements than might otherwise have been possible. Eventually, Tadaaki clashed with the evil prodigy at Koganegahara in Shimosa and killed him, whereupon Itosai awarded him his certificate in the Ito style and gave him the Book of Secret Instructions. Zenki's one flaw had been that his technical capability was marred by a lack of breeding. Not so Kojiro. His intelligence and education were evident in his swordsmanship.
"I can't win this fight," thought Tadaaki,
who felt himself in no way inferior to Munenori. In fact, his assessment of Munenori's skill was not very high. While he stared at his awesome opponent, another truth came home to rest.
"Time appears to have passed me by," he thought ruefully.
They stood motionless. Not the slightest change was evident. But both Tadaaki and Kojiro were expending vital energy at a fearful rate. The physiological toll took the form of sweat pouring copiously from their foreheads, air rushing through flaring nostrils, skin turning white, then bluish. Though a move seemed imminent, the swords remained poised and unwavering.
"I give up," said Tadaaki, abruptly dropping back several paces.
They had agreed it was not to be a fight to the finish. Either man could withdraw by acknowledging defeat. Springing like a beast of prey, Kojiro brought the drying pole into action with a downward stroke of whirlwind force and speed. Though Tadaaki ducked just in time, his topknot flew up and was lopped off. Tadaaki himself, while dodging, executed a brilliant reprisal, slicing off some 6 inches of Kojiro's sleeve.
"Coward!"
rose the cry from the students, whose faces burned with rage. By seizing on his opponent's capitulation as the opening for an attack, Kojiro had violated the samurai's code of ethics. Every one of the students started for Kojiro. He responded by flying with the speed of a cormorant to a large jujube tree at one end of the garden and half-hiding himself behind the trunk. His eyes shifted with intimidating rapidity.
"Did you see it?"
he shouted.
"Did you see who won?"
"They saw it," said Tadaaki.
"Hold off,"
he told his men, sheathing his sword and returning to the veranda of his study. Summoning Omitsu, he told her to tie up his hair. While she was doing this, he caught his breath. His chest glistened with rivulets of sweat. An old saying came back to his mind. It is easy to surpass a predecessor, but difficult to avoid being surpassed by a successor. He'd been enjoying the fruits of hard training in his youth, complacent in the knowledge that his Ito style was no less flourishing than the Yagyu style. Meanwhile, society was giving birth to new geniuses like Kojiro. The realization came as a bitter shock, but he was not the sort of man to ignore it. When Omitsu was finished, he said,
"Give our young guest some water to rinse his mouth out with, and show him back to the guest room."
The faces of the students around him were white with shock. Some were forcing back tears, others stared resentfully at their master.
"We'll assemble in the dojo," he said. "Now."
He himself led the way. Tadaaki took his place on the raised seat in front and silently contemplated the 3 rows of his followers sitting facing him. At length, he lowered his eyes and said quietly,
"I fear that I, too, have become old."
As I look back, it seems to me my best days as a swordsman were when I defeated that devil Zenki. By the time this school was opened and people began talking about the Ono group on Saikachi Slope, calling the Itto style unbeatable, I'd already passed my peak as a swordsman. The meaning of the words was so alien to their customary way of thinking that the students could not believe their ears. His voice became firmer, and he looked directly at their doubting, discontented faces. In my opinion, this is something that happens to all men. Age creeps up on us while we're not looking. Times change. The followers surpass their leaders. A younger generation opens up a new way. This is the way it ought to be, for the world advances only through change. Yet this is inadmissible in the field of swordsmanship. The way of the sword must be a way that does not permit a man to age. Itosai. I don't know if he's still alive. I've had no word from my master for years. After Koganegahara, he took the tonsure and retreated to the mountains. His aim, he said, was to study the sword, to practice Zen, to search for the way of life and death, to climb the great peak of perfect enlightenment. Now, it's my turn. After today, I could no longer hold my head up before my master. I regret I haven't lived a better life.
Master,
broke in Negoro Hachikuro.
You say you lost, but we don't believe you'd lose to a man like Kojiro under normal circumstances, even if he is young. There must have been something wrong today.
Something wrong? Tadaki shook his head and chuckled.
Nothing wrong. Kojiro's young. But that's not why I lost. I lost because the times have changed.
What does that mean?
Listen and see.
He looked from Hachikuro to the other silent faces.
I'll try to make it brief, because Kojiro is waiting for me. I want you to listen carefully to my thoughts and my hopes for the future.
He then informed them that as of this day, he was retiring from the dojo. His intention was not to retire in the ordinary sense, but to follow in the footsteps of Itosai and go out in search of great enlightenment.
That is my first great hope, he told them.
Next, he requested Ito Magobe, his nephew, to take charge of his only son, Tadanari. Magobe was also enjoined to report the day's happenings to the shogunate and explain that Tadaaki had decided to become a Buddhist priest. Then he said,
I have no deep regrets over my defeat by a younger man. What does trouble and shame me is this. New fighters like Sasaki are appearing in other quarters, but not a single swordsman of his caliber has come out of the Ono school. I think I know why. A lot of you are hereditary vassals of the shogun. You've let your status go to your heads. After a bit of training, you begin congratulating yourselves on being masters of the invincible Itto style. You're too self-satisfied.
Wait, sir, Kyosuke protested in a trembling voice. That's not fair. Not all of us are lazy and arrogant. We don't all neglect our studies.
Shut up! Tadaki glared at him fiercely. Laxness on the part of students is a reflection of laxness on the part of the teacher. I'm confessing my own shame now, passing judgment on myself. The task ahead of you is to eliminate laxness, to make the Ono school a center where youthful talent can develop correctly. It must become a training ground for the future. Unless it does, my leaving and making way for a reform will accomplish nothing.
At last, the sincerity of his statement began to take effect. His students hung their heads, pondering his words,
each reflecting on his own shortcomings.
"Hamada!" said Tadaki.
Toranosuke replied,